This is the Josh Hammer Show.
I have very closely followed the career of our guest today, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, since he became Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, since he left his law firm position, since he made the Texas Solicitor General's office something to be emulated in attorneys general offices all across the country. I've been following him, that is to say, ever since he was not a U.S. senator, but since he was a prolific lawyer and a prolific constitutional mind. And Ted Cruz's political career in Washington, D.C. has taken some very interesting turns. He came up during the Tea Party era, and in more recent years, he has had to grapple with the fact that the Tea Party sentiment has given way to post-2016, post-Trump, MAGA-esque nationalist populism. That has been a somewhat uncomfortable at times things, I think, for Senator Cruz to deal with. And look, personally speaking, I was very active with Senator Cruz's 2016 presidential campaign. I'm sure we're going to talk about that a little bit on the program today. Even in 2020, when he wrote his book, One Vote Away, it was a book on the United States Supreme Court, the basic argument that various of our most important, our most cherished constitutional liberties, our freedom of speech, our freedom of religion, Fourth Amendment, Eighth Amendment, you name it, that these votes actually are one vote away. And I worked very closely with Senator Cruz on the entire writing of that manuscript. Heck, the judge that I clerked for years ago on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, the Honorable Judge James C. Ho, who, God willing, will be a United States Supreme Court justice one day. Jim Ho was actually Ted Cruz's handpicked successor as Texas Solicitor General back when Ted stepped down from that position in 2008 and Jim took over in 2008. So I've had my own career kind of overlap with Senator Cruz's in many interesting ways. But the number one thing that I find most interesting about Senator Cruz is his evolution from being something of a firebrand, being something of a wacko bird. Remember that? That's what John McCain famously called Ted Cruz within his first year or two in the Senate. He called him a wacko bird. He has moved from being a wacko bird to being a statesman. That is the proper paradigm that a U.S. senator should be looking at. So I can't wait to get into all this and so much more with Senator Ted Cruz from the great state of Texas. We'll be right back with that interview for you with Senator Ted Cruz.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So what a thrill it is to bring on the show today someone who I've had the distinct pleasure and indeed honor of knowing for a number of years now. That, of course, is the great senator from the great state of Texas, Ted Cruz. Senator Cruz, thank you so much for joining the Josh Hammer Show.
Josh, my friend, good to see you. I'm envious that you get to be in Florida today and I'm stuck in Washington, D.C. The only better choice would be Texas, but right now I'm in D.C.
Such is life, I suppose. So, you know, Senator, there's so much to unpack with you, and I want to get into substance sooner rather than later. But I thought that I would be remiss if I didn't start on a quick point of personal privilege. So, you know, I obviously helped you in 2020 write your New York Times bestselling book, One Vote Away. It was a fantastic project. But it was actually 4 years prior to that, Senator, that you gave me one of my first national claims to fame. It was actually February 1st, 2016. You won the Iowa caucuses. And much to my surprise, it was my dear friend Elliot Geiser, who is now the current Solicitor General of Ohio. We found ourselves getting named shoutouts in your caucus victory speech about 10 minutes into the speech. I remember my Twitter just lighting up. My text messages were incoming. Do you remember that? It was over 8 years ago now. I'm kind of just curious.
I remember it very well, and I was grateful. We were trying to thank people who had done Herculean efforts, who had worked and as you know, we shocked the world when we won Iowa and went on to win 12 other states. And it was due to your efforts and the efforts of a whole lot of people just really rolling up their sleeves and going to work and knocking on doors and reaching out. It was a grassroots campaign, which is an amazing thing.
Yeah, it was a tremendously fun project to be just a tiny, tiny cog in the broader wheel of. And then, of course, the book One Vote Away was just a fantastic project as well. We'll get into the Supreme Court and the current state of lawfare a little later in the show. But, you know, for now, Senator, kind of just maybe just tracing the arc of your Senate career, which I have closely followed since the very beginning. I remember the runoff against David Dewhurst. I remember your showdown with the late Dianne Feinstein when it came to a post-Newtown gun-grabbing bill. One of your first kind of viral moments was the Senate Judiciary Committee Marca moment on a gun-grabbing bill. And I was actually sitting there during my law school orientation at the University of Chicago when you filibustered Obamacare. I remember kind of having a Drudge Report headline, Cruz stands, while my classmates were paying attention to orientation. I had no interest in that. I was just paying attention to what was happening in politics, which was a preview of things to come. And you started, of course, as very much a Tea Party firebrand, and you are still just as strong in your conservative convictions. You have, of course, never wavered. But you've taken on somewhat of a different role over the past few years, which is that of a slightly more senior statesman and more willingness to work across the aisle with some of your Democratic colleagues there. I'm wondering if you could just talk about kind of the evolution of Ted Cruz as a senator and indeed as a statesman.
Well, look, I appreciate the question. What I would say is that it's possible to walk and chew gum at the same time. So I've been in the Senate 12 years, and throughout the 12 years, I've viewed front and center my job as fighting for the people of Texas. And that has often involved fighting against terrible policies, whether it was terrible policies from Barack Obama or terrible policies from Chuck Schumer or terrible policies from Joe Biden. And I've been proud to lead the fight against policies that hurt Texans, whether it's open borders, whether it's the Biden administration's war on oil and gas, whether it is the assault of the left on law enforcement and police, whether it is their efforts to undermine free speech and religious liberty in the Second Amendment. And in every one of those instances, I'm proud to lead the fight to defend the Constitution, to defend the Bill of Rights, to defend the people of Texas. That gets all the press attention, and I understand that. But at the same time, another big, big part of my job is fighting for the people of Texas to deliver real results. And really, from the moment I arrived in the Senate, I've been doing that, introducing legislation, building together coalitions, passing legislation, and getting it signed into law. In the 12 years I've been in the Senate, I've introduced and passed 99 separate pieces of legislation into law. 99 is a lot in 12 years. And if you look at, all right, one of the very first bills that I passed into law is one you'll care about and remember, which is, if you remember Nidal Hassan, the jihadist who murdered 14 innocent souls at Fort Hood in Texas. Well, tragically, the Obama Defense Department refused to award the Purple Heart to those who were killed or those who were wounded by Nidal Hassan. They characterized it as workplace violence instead of what it was, which was an act of terrorism. I was a freshman senator. I was on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and I introduced an amendment to mandate that those who were killed or injured by Nidal Hassan received the Purple Heart. And I ended up getting bipartisan support. Both Democrats and Republicans supported my amendment. They did so over the active opposition of the Obama Defense Department. The Defense Department was arguing, no, we don't want to do this. Well, I got bipartisan support. We passed it into law. And I'll tell you, Josh, I was there at Fort Hood when those Purple Hearts were awarded. And it was powerful to look in the eyes of everyone who was wounded, to look in the eyes of the families of those who were murdered, and to say thank you for your service and sacrifice, and I'm sorry that your federal government took so long to recognize this for what it was. That was one of the very first big victories that I was able to achieve in the Senate, and as I said, there have been 98 more in my 12 years.
Yeah, and that's obviously a phenomenal record of accomplishment in your 12 years thus far. And, you know, God willing, there'll be many more years to come. Looking at the current moment of American politics, many people use the word realignment to describe what is happening. A lot of it is post-2016 and kind of the era of Trump, where you see this kind of the multi-ethnic working class coalition is a term that gets trotted out often. You kind of see some more populist elements on both the left and the right there. A lot of issues are very much in flux. I'm kind of curious what issues you see that are actually ripe for bipartisan legislation and statesmanship. Big tech comes potentially to mind. No one seems to be very happy with the big tech oligarchs, but I worry that the two sides hate big tech for very opposite reasons, actually. So I'm kind of curious how you see that.
Well, look, I think big tech and censorship is an area where you can have bipartisan agreement. So, for example, a bill that I've authored with Ed Markey deals with AM radio in cars. And we saw last year 8 major car manufacturers announced that they were pulling AM radio off of all new cars and all new trucks. Now, I think that's a terrible idea. And I think it's an example, much like big tech censorship. I think these car manufacturers are doing it because talk radio is a place where conservatives can be heard, where you're not censored, where free speech is abundant, and big business right now wants to silence speech. So I ended up teaming up with Ed Markey. Look, Ed Markey may be the most liberal member of the Senate. He serves with Elizabeth Warren out of Massachusetts. He's a very liberal Democrat, and we had a bill that's called AM radio for every vehicle. I'll tell you, the day we filed that bill, the next day, one of those car makers, Ford, announced they were reversing policy and they were going to put AM radio back. And I think they looked and said, you know what? If you got Cruz and Markey both on the same bill, we're in a world of trouble. We give up. It may be a sign of the apocalypse. We've moved the bill through the Commerce Committee. We got unanimous support in the Commerce Committee, Republicans and Democrats. I'm the ranking member, the senior Republican on the Commerce Committee. And so it's moved through the Commerce Committee. It's headed to the floor. But that's, I think, an example where you can get that kind of bipartisan coalition. I'll give you another example, which is a bill that I just passed into law in December that was a really important bill. And it dealt with bridges from Texas to Mexico. So the way this issue came to me, it goes back 2-3 years ago. A group from Laredo came to DC to meet with me, and it was elected officials, it was business leaders, and then they were expressing frustration. There are right now 4 new bridge projects pending in South Texas to build new bridges across the Rio Grande River to Mexico. And either new bridges or expand existing bridges. And all 4 of them were running into bureaucratic roadblocks from the Biden White House. And it's interesting, the elected officials are almost all Democrats in Texas. And they were frustrated out of their mind. Why is the Biden White House slowing these projects down by years after years? And they asked me, would you help us? And I said, of course, I'm happy to. And somewhat naively, I thought it'd be simple. I thought I could just make a phone call to the State Department that they would see reason and they'd fix it. Well, turns out that was wrong. They told me go jump in a lake. So what I did next is or maybe jump in a river, you decide. What I did next is work to pull together a bipartisan coalition, and I unified the South Texas congressional delegation. So I drafted a letter to Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State. It was joined by John Cornyn, my colleague in the Senate. It was joined by Henry Cuellar, a Democrat, Monica de la Cruz, a Republican, Vicente Gonzalez, a Democrat, and Tony Gonzalez, a Republican. All of us joined it together saying, look, this policy, it's stupid. It's delaying development. It's hurting South Texas. You need to change it. Again, the Biden administration said, go jump in a lake. So I responded by drafting legislation that mandated that they accelerate the permitting. I introduced it in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, on which I serve, got bipartisan support for that legislation, passed it out of committee, passed it out of the full Senate with huge bipartisan support. It went to the House. Henry Cuellar, a Democrat, whipped Democrat votes for me. I whipped Republican votes. We passed it out of the House with overwhelming bipartisan support. And it was signed into law in December of last year, actually on December 22nd, on my birthday.
Oh, wow.
Now, I'll tell you, the Texas Association of Business says this bridges legislation that I passed is the most significant bill for U.S.-Mexico trade since the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. Texas does every year about $800 billion of trade with Mexico, and this will accelerate the legal transfer of goods and commerce. It will produce billions of dollars of new economic activity in Texas, thousands and thousands of new jobs, and it's an example where you can bring people together for a bipartisan victory, even if it's overcoming the Biden administration that is putting unreasonable policies in place.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal example. Thank you for illustrating that for the listeners. And, you know, I have to tell you, just speaking of Texas, I live in Florida now, Senator, as you know, but I did live in Texas for 4 years. I clerked for a mutual friend, Judge Ho, on the Fifth Circuit. And I think that you will personally get a kick out of the fact, at least, that my concealed carry license to this day is a Texas license, although I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure how much that's necessary, because both Texas and Florida are constitutional carry states, thank God, these days. But in any event, I carry around my Texan identity in my wallet very much to this day. So I want to transition. Senator, speaking of the Second Amendment and legal issues and all of that. So as I mentioned earlier, I was honored to work very closely with you on the 2020 book, One Vote Away, which was a New York Times bestseller, all about your prolific legal career and the Supreme Court and all of that there. So I want to get into some current cases before the court. But before I do so, you know, we worked on that book in 2020 before Justice Ginsburg passed away. So the makeup of the Supreme Court has shifted a little bit. Justice Jackson obviously was not on the court back then. So what do you make of the current Supreme Court? We've had a couple of pretty high profile terms in a row. What's your assessment of the current state of play there?
Look, I am very excited by where the Supreme Court is right now. And I'll tell you, you and I, we worked for the better part of a year on that book, One Vote Away. I've written four books. I think One Vote Away may well be the best of the four. It's a really good book. By the way, it is, I think, an excellent book for anyone who's in law school, anyone who's in college and interested in the Supreme Court, even anyone who's in high school. It's a book that I think is useful as a textbook, because what you and I did together is every chapter focuses on a different constitutional right. And the book consists of war stories. Litigators, there's nothing you like to do more than tell war stories. So it brings people inside litigating some of the biggest cases in the country year after year after year in front of the Supreme Court, dealing with our major constitutional rights, whether free speech or religious liberty or the Second Amendment. And it lays it out, but it's telling it from the inside, the stories of arguing the cases and winning the cases. And the point that it makes over and over again is that most of our victories establishing our fundamental rights have been 5-4. We're one vote away from losing those constitutional rights. And likewise, most of the cases where we lost and did not have the Constitution protected were 5-4 decisions the other way. And so the point of the book was one vote. The subtitle of the book is How One Supreme Court Seat Can Change History. When we wrote it, it came out in the fall, and it came out the same week that Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. And that obviously we didn't plan, but it powerfully illustrated the consequences of it. And if you look at the current court, look, Amy Coney Barrett is incredibly important to have on the court. Among all the decisions, the Dobbs decisions was historic. And we talked about, we have a whole chapter on life. We talked about the decisions on, for example, upholding the federal ban on partial birth abortion had been 5-4. So we talked about that and explained what ultimately became the foundation for Dobbs, which is the court saying questions of abortion are deeply divisive. People have strong, emotional, passionate disagreements on both sides. And under the Constitution, the way the Constitution resolves those questions is we leave them to the voters. It's democracy that decides, not nine unelected judges, but rather the voters. And I think we explain that effectively in One Vote Away.
Yeah, no, it really is a fantastic book, and I'm happy that you made the plug for law students and even for high schoolers and college students, because it is readily accessible. You know, I think my personal favorite chapter of the book was probably what I probably view as your greatest case, which is Medean versus Texas, which is a little legally in the weeds, but I remember reading that as a law student in my foreign relations law class and just being so impressed as how Texas essentially beat the Bush administration, beat the United Nations, beat basically everyone in what is clearly a legally correct outcome. So I very much would also encourage the listeners to go ahead and check out Ted Cruz's 2020 book, One Vote Away. So we're going to take it to a very quick commercial break here. We're joined again by the great Senator Ted Cruz from the great state of Texas. More with Senator Cruz when we come back.
This is the Josh Hammer Show.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
We're joined once again by Senator Ted Cruz of the great state of Texas. So, Senator, let's stay on the topic of the Supreme Court just for a few more minutes here. There are some big upcoming decisions from the court. There is this huge oral argument coming up very shortly when it comes to the scope of presidential immunity. This is, pertains to Jack Smith's D.C. probe of Donald Trump, of course. And then we're also expecting a potentially huge ruling when it comes to Chevron deference, which is a little legally in the weeds, but is actually a profound importance. So what are you focused on as to what's coming down the pipeline right now at the court?
Well, listen, the case dealing with Chevron deference is enormously important. Chevron deference is a doctrine the court created that gives enormous deference to regulatory agencies. So if an agency puts out a regulation, even if it doesn't derive from the statute, the courts defer to the regulatory agency. And Chevron deference has helped create the administrative state, which I think has ultimately been harmful to liberty. And it has been harmful to democratic accountability because these bureaucrats are in a very real sense unaccountable to the people. They are in windowless offices in D.C. and with the flick of a pen, they'll destroy billions of dollars of economic activity. They'll destroy jobs. And I think it is right under our Constitution that if you're making decisions that significantly affect people's lives, that it ought to be the elected officials who are accountable to the voters and who the voters can throw out. The number one check is throwing the bums out. And so I'm actually quite optimistic. I think the Supreme Court this term is going to overturn Chevron deference and is going to say, look, the operative source of law is the statute that was passed by Congress and signed by the president, and unelected bureaucrats don't have the authority to rewrite the statute that is actually what is the law in the United States.
So I share your optimism. I actually also agree that the court is far likelier than not to finally do what needs to be done to Chevron deference. I guess one follow-up question for you. You know, even if they overturn Chevron, which, as you correctly say, would have the practical effect of reducing the independence, for lack of a better term, of the administrative state, would that still actually want to make legislators legislate again? Because we do live in a world of somewhat perverse incentives where, you know, people just want to go preen for the cameras. I mean, you were talking earlier about all your dirty work getting actual laws passed, which is laudable and commendable. But do you think that it would actually practically change how the House and Senate work day to day?
I don't know. You're certainly right that there are a lot of members of Congress who are happy to abdicate responsibility, who are happy to have the unelected members of the administrative state make the hard decisions. And that's because, listen, the dominant instinct in Congress is risk aversion. That there's an old joke that politics is Hollywood for ugly people. And there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, you have people who
present company excluded.
Well, you know, look, there's no other business where you can have short, fat, bald guys go to parties and every joke they tell is funny. People are paying attention to them. And what happens? You have members that look in the mirror and they say, I am a senator. Gosh, golly, I'm important. And they're desperate not to lose that position. It's what results in a lot of the problems we have in Washington. It's why I'm such a big fan of term limits. I think if you had term limits and you threw the bums out, the country would be better off. But I also think we need things like, for example, legislation that I have co-sponsored year after year is legislation called the RAINS Act. The RAINS Act says any economic regulation that imposes $100 million or more of cost on the economy cannot go into effect without an affirmative up-down vote from Congress. That would be the most significant federal regulatory reform ever passed. Why? Because it would make members of Congress take responsibility so that if you're a member of Congress and you're going to vote to destroy someone's job, you got to walk down on the floor and you got to say, thumbs up, I'm for taking away your job. That democratic accountability, I think, would be really powerful. Now, the Democrats don't want it, but it's something I've been fighting for 12 years. And if we have next year, if Donald Trump is president, if we have a Republican Senate, Republican House, it's going to be right at the top of what I'm going to be fighting for again, because I think we need to be protecting jobs. My number one priority is jobs, and out of control Washington regulation kills jobs.
100%. And the RAINS Act is another example of commonsensical legislation that really ought to pass. But unfortunately, you know, the whole Bismarckian sausage making process sometimes has other ideas. So, you know, in our main time, Senator, let's transition to another issue that alongside the Supreme Court and the judiciary, I know is of profound interest for both you and I, and that is the state of Israel and U.S.-Israel relations. Yeah. You know, I remember talking to you many years ago, Senator, and you telling me how when you were a fairly young child growing up in Houston, Texas, and there was the Entebbe raid in 1976, yeah. One of the most daring military operations, really that any military has probably successfully achieved over the past half century or so. And the only casualty of that operation was the brother of the current prime minister of Israel. Yeah. That would be Yoni Netanyahu. His nephew, Yair Netanyahu, was actually a previous guest as well here on the Josh Hammer Show. So I know that this issue is near and dear to your heart, Senator. And I think I probably speak for both of us when I say that I'm just so disheartened when I see speeches like Chuck Schumer's recent speech, when I see the current state of play when it comes to, I mean, not just pro-Palestinian, to actually pro-Hamas anarchists and protesters throughout America. I kind of just throw my hands up. I mean, what in the world is going on right now when it comes to the American left and the Jews in Israel?
Look, the Democrat Party has gotten radicalized, and it is profoundly dangerous. And as you know, I do a podcast every week, Verdict with Ted Cruz. We do it Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We've got just under 1 million unique listeners. So every week I'm beating CNN on the Verdict podcast, and we talk a lot about foreign policy. We talk a lot about Israel, and a point that I've made on the podcast repeatedly is the problem is not just the squad. It's not just the radical fringe left, the Ilhan Omars and the Talibs and the AOCs in the House. Now, look, they are rabidly anti-Israel. They repeatedly make anti-Semitic tropes. They're a problem. But the real problem is the so-called mainstream of the Democrat Party. The real problem is Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. It was Chuck Schumer, as you noted, who stood on the Senate floor and demanded that the democratically elected leader of Israel be thrown out. That has never happened in our nation's history. And Schumer didn't call for the leader of Hamas to be thrown out, for the leader of Iran, for the leader of Russia or China or North Korea. He chose the world's only Jewish state. And by the way, it wasn't the squad, it was Joe Biden that orchestrated a resolution at the UN effectively condemning Israel and demanding that they enter into a ceasefire and stop trying to kill Hamas terrorists. And it also wasn't the squad, it was Nancy Pelosi who just recently signed a letter saying we should cut off military aid to Israel. And it was Joe Biden who flowed $100 billion to Iran. That funded October 7th. That funded the missiles and drones that were just fired at Israel. They were paid for in a very real sense by Joe Biden and the Democrats. And I'll tell you, if you look back a couple of months ago on the day of the March for Israel, over 300,000 people came to the National Mall. I was down there marching. On that day, I and a number of other Republican senators, we went to the floor, we forced a vote on emergency military aid to Israel, and every single Democrat voted no, all of them. There'd been several Democrats down at the March for Israel. Jackie Rosen from Nevada was literally on the stage speaking at the March for Israel, and she went straight to the Senate floor and voted no, we will not provide emergency military aid to Israel. Today, in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I had an amendment to sanction Iran's ghost fleet, which is how they sell 2 million barrels a day of oil, mostly to communist China. It's what funds Hamas. It's what funds Hezbollah. It's what funds their drones and their cruise missiles. Every single Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted no. I had another amendment to sanction every member of Hamas. Every single Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted no. What we've seen, and it's really frightening, Josh, the Democrat Party is scared of the radical left. And, you know, there's a joke I'm told in Jerusalem about Chuck Schumer's speech calling on Netanyahu to be thrown out of office. And the joke is that it was entirely about the two-state solution, the two states being Michigan and Nevada.
Right. No, that's exactly right. I think I heard your colleague Senator Rubio say that same joke on a different show. And I guess it's right, but even on its own terms, Senator, it doesn't make sense, does it? Because for every jihadi that you actually might win over in Dearborn, Michigan, or in Ilhan Omar's district in Minneapolis, you're not going to win over. In fact, you're probably going to lose the reasonable, logical American in Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, all these other swing states. So even on its own terms, I don't think it makes sense. So is it actually not playing politics, but just this zealous creeping in of this anti-Western civilization ideology, the ideology that was working in the background perniciously to guide Barack Obama during the Iran nuclear deal? Yeah. I mean, those chickens are coming home to roost now, aren't they?
Absolutely. And what you're referencing now is my most recent book. My most recent book is entitled Unwoke: How to Defeat Cultural Marxism in America. And if you want to know why this is happening, you know, a couple of months ago, I was visiting with a very successful tech entrepreneur who's a man of the left. He's always been a Democrat, a man of the left. And he was expressing befuddlement. Where is this vicious anti-Israel sentiment coming from? Where is this vicious anti-Semitism that we're seeing on university campuses all over? And he's like, I don't understand. Where did this come from? And my answer is, I said, look, this is cultural Marxism. The left has defined Israelis and has defined Jews as oppressors. And the left has defined Palestinians as victims. And the central tenets of cultural Marxism is that they always, always, always support the so-called victims against the so-called oppressors. And in particular, they support the violent revolutionary overthrow of the victims against the oppressors. And it's why so many people on the left literally celebrated the October 7th atrocities. It's why Black Lives Matter chapters put out tweets. The Black Lives Matter in Chicago put out a tweet with a paraglider. As you know, paragliders came in to the outdoor concert and massacred young people. The left, the people who are marching on campuses, who are chanting from the river to the sea, are calling for the annihilation of Israel. That is today's left, because they have embraced the tenets of Marxism, and it is, we are seeing, as you put, the chickens coming home to roost.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But once again, I mean, I'm just even taking this critical theory, oppressors, oppressed dichotomy, even taking it on its own terms, it doesn't work. I think a lot of people have this idea that Israel is filled with Larry Davids and Jerry Seinfeld. It's literally not true. I mean, you've been many times, you know this, but just for the listeners, I mean, I'm an Ashkenazi Jew who married a Sephardic Jew. My wife's skin tone is actually quite a bit darker. In fact, you know, we've been to Mexico twice together. They try speaking to her in Spanish because she kind of sort of, in a way, I guess, resembles that. But that's just not the reality on the ground. So neither their facts, nor their logic, nor their ideology, all of it is just total garbage. But I just find it very, very scary seeing this small but very, very loud and apparently well-funded group of anarchists just shutting bridges and airports down in the name of a U.S. recognized foreign terrorist organization. The mind just really reels. But in any event, this has been a wonderful conversation with you, Senator. This is Senator Ted Cruz of the great state of Texas. Really, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Josh. Great to see you.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
It's Hammer Time.
DEI lives on after a major Supreme Court ruling this week. This is a ruling in the Muldrow case where there were no dissenting opinions filed. It was a majority opinion written by the liberal justice Elena Kagan, and then you had three of the right of center justices concurring in the judgment. So America First Legal, which is headed up by the great Stephen Miller, they are all on top of this, and they're saying this is going to factor into their strategy moving forward. So the threshold for some workplace bias claims has been adjusted as a result of this Muldrow decision ruling, but they could have done a heck of a lot more, to put it mildly, that is to say the Supreme Court, when it comes to trying to legally roll back the DEI regime and ultimately hold that a lot of this is simply incompatible with our Civil Rights Act, with the civil rights law. This gets to a broader frustration, of course, which is the idea that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was inspired by nothing short of the Declaration of Independence and the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th through 15th Amendments themselves, which is to say this idea of colorblind equality. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was striving to end Jim Crow segregation, state-sanctioned segregation, by saying that we actually are all created equal. And what you've had, of course, is the exact opposite take place. That's how you have the rise of DEI, the rise of affirmative action. You have these bureaucrats and these judges and all sorts of folks all across the country who have totally bastardized the Civil Rights Act of 1964 into being something that it utterly was not supposed to be. This is the brilliant thesis put forth in the book a few years ago by Christopher Caldwell, a fellow at the Claremont Institute. Unfortunately, there's really no remedy for this short of direct congressional legislation that is going to actually just get rid of this stuff nationwide and hold that actual racial discrimination is incompatible with the Civil Rights Act and or a sweeping Supreme Court ruling. For the interim state term measures, the ban that we have here in Florida, Texas, Iowa, Alabama just signed a recent law. So some states are getting in on the anti-DEI game, thank God. Ultimately, this is going to have to be resolved in some capacity at the federal level. Black UF alums are calling for the school to reinstate their diversity program. So this is a new group calling itself the Coalition of Concerned Black University of Florida Alumni. They are demanding that $45 million be dedicated to re-implement DEI programs after their president there at UF, Ben Sasse, the former U.S. Senator from Nebraska, as well as, of course, the governor here, Ron DeSantis, and our legislature, the Florida legislature, banned DEI from public universities. What else is the Coalition of Concerned Black University of Florida alumni demanding? Well, they're demanding to appoint a Black University of Florida graduate to the school's board of trustees, and then they also want to boost efforts to increase its allegedly declining Black student enrollment. Look, I don't even know what to say to stories like this at this point. When you get into the game of demanding that you appoint a Black University of Florida graduate, where do you stop? I mean, how many board of trustee members can there possibly be at one university? 10, 15, 20? Are we going to need someone who has a pink hair? Does the pink hair community demand that there's someone be on the UF board of trustees who matches their idiosyncratic choice of hair color? Look, I am Jewish. Do I particularly care whether there are any Jews on the Board of Trustees? No, I actually really don't. And on the contrary, if they come from a very progressive sect of American Judaism, I don't want them anywhere near the Board of Trustees. I don't want them anywhere near positions of power at all, because their ideas are very, very bad and toxic. And more generally speaking, that is the proper way to view any particular public policy issue, is not through the identity of the person, but through the idea. As Martin Luther King Jr. famously said, judge me not by the color of my skin, but by the content of my character, or as the case may be, by the ideas that are put forward. This really should be common sense stuff. West Virginia girls step out of track and field meet to protest a transgender competitor. So a federal judicial decision ruled that a West Virginia law barring biological boys from competing on girls' sports teams cannot be enforced with regard to a 13-year-old boy who competes on the girls' track and field team. And what do you know? The biological male went ahead and won the shot put event at the local championship. Well, what do you know? When you have Shapa, which is going to involve something that touches upon basic hormonal structure, basic hormonal bone density, muscle mass, basic biological anatomical functions, where the male and the female bodies simply are not the same thing. I think back to those infamous photos of Leah Thomas, so-called Leah Thomas, whatever, swimming in the pool up and down, back and forth, just dominating Riley Gaines and all the other NCAA swimmers. How many more stark visual examples do lawmakers, judges, and the body politic in general need to put an end to this assault? And it's ultimately an assault, by the way, on womanhood. It is ultimately an assault on womanhood and on femininity. And, you know, the acronym TERF gets put out there these days to describe people like J.K. Rowling. They call it, what do they call it? They call it trans-exclusive radical feminists. You know, honestly, I'm happy to make common cause with the TERFs when it comes to the issue of biological males competing in women's sports. At some point, you're going to have some people getting very, very seriously hurt if this goes any further. And I just fear it's going to end very tragically. So, speaking of that very same note, another major headline of the week, Biden has inserted gender identity into Title IX. So, he has added biological males into the corpus of women's rights laws. They unveiled their long-awaited overhaul of Title IX, inserting gender identity into this watershed amendment from the early 1970s. It reminds me in many ways of the Bostock Supreme Court decision from 2020, where you had Justice Neil Gorsuch read sexual orientation and gender identity into Title VII, a separate provision of the Civil Rights Act. Again, this is not going to end well. It is going to end, I greatly fear, that is to say, in tragedy. Ultimately, to put a stop to these shenanigans, what I really fear is that it's going to take you the people rising up, going to your local election, the presidential election if the case may be this fall, and saying, no, I will not stand for biological men to run roughshod over women, because these ideologues, these cultural Marxist zealots in Washington, D.C., that is the agenda that they are shoving down our throats, and they will continue to do so until you stand up and say, no, I'm not going to have it. Finally, drag queen cancels a story hour at a Pennsylvania church after a backlash. A drag queen story hour event was moved from a library venue to a theologically progressive church, but then the church actually went ahead and canceled it. So here's your feel-good story of the week here. Look, I mean, some notion of autonomy obviously applies when it comes to a church, synagogue, any kind of private institution designed to host within the confines of its doors what it wants to. I don't particularly care whether you are a theologically conservative or a theologically progressive or a theologically whatever, church, synagogue, whatever. Last I checked, we all believed in Genesis 1:27, God made man and woman in his image, male and female, he created them. And even holding that aside, drag queen story hour is just disgusting.
This is the Josh Hammer Show.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.